fell right down that rabbit hole. So reality is questionable. Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on a show. It's paranormal overload with Southern hospitality. Haunted murder, mayhem, tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Hunt, Heather Dog Ninja.
Sometimes their cat, Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hi, this is Diane.
And this is Kelly.
Of the History Goes Bump podcast. And you're listening to
Hillbilly Horror Stories.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 375 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
Tracy, we like to start off all of our stories by thanking our military and civil servants all over the world, no matter which country you represent. Thanks to all you men, women, and service animals for everything you do to keep us safe and keep us free on a regular basis.
Yes, we definitely appreciate you guys so much, and we need to realize how lucky and fortunate we are. Our hearts and prayers still go out to Israel. Just, I can't even hardly stand to look at the news anymore because it's just so devastating and heartbreaking, and I cannot imagine how the people over there are dealing with this at all. So we are so grateful for our armed forces, for having our backs, for watching over us so we can rest at night. We love you guys so much.
Absolutely. Also, we want to make sure that we let people know that if you are suffering in any type of a way mentally, please treat that like any other illness that you would have. If you had a really bad twisted ankle, you would seek help for it. If you had back pains, if you had, cancer or something like that, you would seek help for that medical attention. Please treat mental health the exact same way.
Yes, definitely. You guys, we are always here. If you need to talk, we'll give you our numbers. You can get with the group. There's somebody always there for you guys. It's so important to us that you all reach out. Please, please don't hesitate to do that. Also, if you want to go the route of the crisis number, it is 988, and you can text 741-741, but we're always there. Please reach out day or night. We'll do our best to just listen and help in any way.
Guys, we are in Florida.
True that.
As we're actually coming back from Florida by the time you hear this, so this isn't a brand new episode, but we reached way back into the archives and we pulled out a Patreon episode from November of 2019. So the majority of you haven't heard it. It will be new to you.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you were a Patreon subscriber back then,
uh-huh.
You probably haven't heard the story. It's actually a couple of stories UFO related for those of you who claim we don't do it. So cryptids last week, UFO this week.
Okay.
That should free us up for another 4 or 5 years. Not to do any of those. But I think you guys are really going to enjoy this. And we have a special guest.
Yes.
We have Betsy Kulikowski on. Betsy is an author, but even more importantly to me, she has a degree in emergency management. She has actually been on the scenes at where the Oklahoma State bombing took place, doing work shortly after the bombing. She was only 6 blocks away when it happened.
Wow, no way.
Her parents were supposed to be there that day.
Oh my gosh.
And just by pure... she tells me the story. I'll let her tell it, but it was just one of those things to where if any one of these couple of things would have been a little different, they may have been at that building that
day.
Wow. But she was at the Twin Towers.
Mm.
She was Hurricane Rita and Katrina relief.
Bless her heart.
She has been all over this country.
Yes.
Doing things like that.
Yes.
And absolutely amazing. But she's got paranormal stories. She's got stories about her book. We talk about all that. You guys are going to be excited to hear that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for all that you do to help. It's so much appreciated, and I'm sure you know that.
So we're not going to end the show. We're just, there won't be a proper ending as usual. There won't be any kind of speaking about Patreon or anything like that. The only thing we will add that I'll add here is that it was just announced last week that we will be doing a live show at CryptidCon.
Yay.
That's November 18th and 19th in Lexington, Kentucky. There is no cost for our show. If you come to CryptidCon, mm-hmm. you get a ticket. You can just stay, and right as things wrap up Saturday night, we're doing a show right afterwards, so you don't even have to miss anything else going on.
Great. So
get your tickets, CryptidCon.com. Come out and see us. Now, we're going to go ahead and play this episode for you, and then I'm going to follow that immediately with Betsy, and that'll be the end of it. But we appreciate you guys.
We love you guys and hope you all have a blessed week.
Listening to the Hillbilly Horror Stories Patreon bonus episode. Please welcome your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Pauly.
Hey guys, and welcome to the November bonus episode. November 2019.
Where'd a year go?
I don't know. It flew though.
It sure did.
So it happened when you're old and you're sitting there thinking about, I only got so many years left. And all of a sudden the year goes by really quick and you're like, slow down.
Yeah, for real.
Slow down. Okay. Let's do this episode.
Okay, let's do it.
I know that we don't do very many UFO episodes, but I found a few abduction stories that I found extremely interesting. So not only are we going to do some UFO stuff tonight, which tonight is going to be a little different because we're going to do an abduction story, but then we're also going to do like famous celebrities and their UFO sightings. There's like a bunch of them, so we're just going to skim through them.
Oh, cool.
So thought it'd be kind of fun. But Sunday's show is actually one of the most famous stories in Canada and another story from Australia that I thought was cool. And one we're doing tonight is actually from Canada, too. So,
yeah, we need to send out our prayers to everybody in Australia, too, with this big, huge fire that's going. It's just heartbreaking.
So, anyways, you're going to get some UFO stories tonight, and you're going to turn around and get some on Sunday. And then we'll probably go another 10 months without ever doing a UFO story.
No.
So, that's the reality of it. Okay, so we're going to start with this first story, and it involves a young lady up in Canada by the name of Karina Sables. We'll get into a little more. She's up in British Columbia. But I ran across this group of stories on UFO abductions, and I found one that involved her, and it was a little short story, so I looked it up to see if there was a little more on that story,
mm-hmm.
and I found all kinds of other stuff that's not even connected to that story.
Oh.
So just to tell you the story that I saw, this was, I think, 1993, and I'm going off memory because I didn't write any of this down on this mm-hmm. one, so I'll just give it to you in a nutshell. She had split up with her husband, had some kids. They moved to British Columbia, and she met this guy named Tom, and he decided that, you know, hey, I really like you. I think, you know, we're talking marriage. That's what she said. He's talking marriage. He comes over to her house one night. I guess the kids are in bed. It's a warm night. So they decide to go outside and have tea
mm-hmm.
on the outside balcony. So while they're sitting there, she's just kind of leaned back in her chair. And she said she feels this strange feeling in her stomach, almost like vibrations in her stomach. And then she said, next thing you know, there is a ship right above him. He sees it. She sees it. He's freaked out. She's just kind of staring at it. And he's like, come on, we need to go inside. She doesn't go inside.
No. Oh.
He goes inside, though.
He left her out there?
Yeah, he's like, you're on your own. He leaves her out there. She says a few minutes later, it goes away. He comes back out. And he's like, where have you been? She's like, what do you mean, where you been? I've been right here the whole time. He's like, no, I came out here. You weren't here. I looked, went all back through the woods. I looked through there. You know, I looked all around the front of the house and the back. You know, I've looked everywhere. You weren't here. She's like, I'm telling you, I've been here the whole time. He said, you've been gone for 45 minutes to an hour.
Oh, whoa.
And then he, you know, all of a sudden went into this, well, I'm not going to fool with all these disappearing acts and all this stuff. This is absolutely crazy. So he leaves. And then the next day, he basically sends her a message and said this isn't something he can deal with. And he's just through.
Wow, what a quitter.
So let me tell you where the problem in this is. And it's not really that it's a problem. It's that you'll see when we start talking about the other stories that come up where there might be some people not really sure about the credibility of it. So let's analyze that story for a second. He sees the ship too, but he don't remember any of that.
Oh, he don't?
No, he don't remember any of that. He just knows she was outside and then she disappeared and for 45 minutes he couldn't find her. But I mean, her car was still out there. So where would she have gone?
Yeah.
And are you that quick to give up on a relationship one time?
Oh, yeah.
Because you say she, you know, it's just, I don't know, something about it just seems funny. So the long and short of this is, I saw that video and I'm like, well, let me go see what else is on her. Well, I find these other stories and these stories don't even mention that one. So the thing that we're going to remember about this, and I said there were some discrepancies and stuff like that. The abductions of Corina Sables, which is her name, it says that it's one of the most controversial and outlandish claims on record. That's what it says. And that's not even talking about that episode. It says even within the UFO community, there's like a lot of people that think that she might just be full of it, trying to do it for the money, trying to get a book deal or something like that. So that's kind of the thought within. So we're going to start this story by saying that even a lot of people in the UFO community that are big believers think there's something funny with her story.
Well, then he would have to be in on it, wouldn't he?
Or he could have just been made up.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no proof other than her story. There's no interview with him or anything. Now, she does have some kind of proof and stuff, and we'll get into some of that, some physical injuries and markings and stuff like that that could be taken as proof. So according to her report, Corina says her and a friend, and her friend, here's another thing, wishes only to be known as Jane Doe. She doesn't want to use her name.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got somebody else in her stories that, and I'm not saying that, it, you know, somebody might not want to look at as they're, you know, off their rocker or a lunatic or you're making stuff up. So, you know, it's not crazy to think that someone wouldn't want their real name involved in something.
Yeah,
like this.
I understand that.
So anyway, Corina and this Jane Doe are supposed to be like really good friends. And Jane decides that she's going to drive up to Glenmore, British Columbia, where Corina lives. And they're just going to have like a little girls' weekend or whatever. So shortly after midnight on the 31st of July, 2003 is when this takes place. They decided they want to go take a drive so they could watch some stars. But she probably didn't have any stars at her house. They said that traffic was relatively busy, especially for such a late hour. They wouldn't expect it to be as busy as what it was. And that had come into play a little bit. It started to decrease shortly before they found a spot and pulled off the road. Now, Corina said that she used her flashlight to kind of highlight the points above, like in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So she's using a flashlight. She's pointing to some places up there. And her friend was using her binoculars to kind of look around up in the sky. And within a few seconds, she just found these three stars up in the sky that were like in a triangle shape. And she said that they were extremely bright and like a solid white. So they didn't twinkle like regular stars was.
Oh,
that's what caught her attention.
Oh.
She said then, though, they kind of start moving all as one object. So the triangle's moving them all in the same way. They're not separating.
Do stars always have to twinkle?
No, but they usually do, though.
Yeah.
So the two women kind of thought, well, it must be a plane. So they quickly just dismissed the idea, though, because they said planes don't stop and hover, and this thing did.
Oh, yeah, no way.
So now the lights are starting to change color to a neon green.
No.
Then it comes to a stop. And they happen to notice that now there's no traffic at all outside. There's like no cars on the freeway.
What?
It's like them on the side and seeing this thing. So Corina reaches for the car's headlights and she turns them off. She then takes the flashlight. She kind of swings it around the area all around them. And what she's looking for is some kind of animals because she says there's a bunch of animals that lurk in the area there. And she wants to kind of see if she can see the eyeballs, because, you know, they've kind of, when you shine a flashlight on these animals like cats and dogs and all that. She said that she went right underneath where these lights were hovering in the sky, and she could see five sets of eyeballs looking right at them. So at first, she kind of thought these were like a pack of wild animals, somehow, some way. Then, though, she said, once you really look, your brain just kind of takes all this in. And in front of them, heading their way, were five creatures. They were around 4 feet tall, thin gray shoulders, and they had a really thin frame. She said a surge of fear just kind of rushed through her, so much so that she began to kind of struggle to breathe, like a panic attack. She told her friend, hey, go get the car. And both women struggled to go get the car, though. And she said it was like everything went in slow motion. It was like they were moving through quicksand.
Oh.
So despite all this, they eventually end up reaching the car. They got in the car, slammed the car doors, and they noticed that the windows, though, were still down. And it's a power windows. So they had to start the car. So they were sitting there panicking that these things are coming and the windows are down.
Yeah, that would be our luck.
They tried, and of course,
the windows
ignition wouldn't come on.
Oh, man.
So finally, they said all the car's electrical things, the gauges and stuff, were just going nuts. But then the car started. So they rolled the windows up, and then they sped away from the area as quick as they could. They did a turnaround in the middle of the road and headed back to the direction they came. So after several moments, they realized that increasingly more traffic was around their car. So when they took off, there was like no traffic. Then all of a sudden, the traffic started picking up again. So they asked each other, where would all these vehicles have been coming from? Because they weren't there a second ago.
Yeah.
And perhaps more importantly, though, was why was there no traffic only moments ago when the strange creatures were heading towards them?
I guess nobody asked anybody else in any other cars.
No, not that I could see. So then she starts, you know, heading down the road. And she said that her friend had the weirdest feeling as though there was like electricity running through her body. I'm talking about Jane Doe. She said it was like she got zapped from a battery. However, the two women noticed that the clock on the car's dashboard, and they both kind of froze because they said they'd only been out of the car just a matter of minutes, not even 5 minutes, they didn't think. However, according to the time, almost a half hour had gone by. So time had kind of disappeared, and neither one of the women could even think of where this time could have went, because they knew they weren't out of the car in no time.
Wow, that's real weird.
So they start to discuss, did they possibly share a hallucination?
Yeah.
Or had they imagined the whole thing, which would have been odd?
How that could happen.
As they got closer and closer to home, though, they rode by this really large field. There was a glowing neon green ball out there in the field. This time, it was really low. Really low. Like almost to the ground. It would move and then stop, move and then stop. It did this a bunch of different times. And eventually, Karina would bring the car to halt, to stop. She left the car running smartly. Yeah. And as soon as she did this, the object began to kind of approach them at a really quick speed. Suddenly, it was right over top of their car. So Karina pressed down hard on the gas and the car sped away. But instead of remaining on the road, she decided to take a little shortcut through an orchard. And she kind of went in and out of some trees and everything there. And eventually, she did bring the car to a stop. She turned off the lights and turned the car off. She was kind of hoping that she would not be able to be seen by this thing, obviously. And, you know, it would just move on and she'd go on her very way. So they sat there for a couple minutes. And Jane told Karina, she's like, look out the front window of the car. And high above them, they could actually see a green light. There was three of them, and they were all hovered overhead, and they said, but you could see it through the trees. So at that moment, the object moved, and all the green lights kind of moved together. After a little bit of time, they appeared to separate and go different ways, the lights did, each moving independently from the other. So taking their chance, Karina and her buddy decided that they turned back the car turned the car back on, and then they sped away. This time, though, they got all the way to Karina's house, and, you know, they would make a few more discoveries once they got to the house. So after a short little talk about what happened during the night, the two women decided to go to bed and try to get some kind of sleep. However, upon walking in the following morning, they would discover some strange markings and bruises on their bodies that they didn't notice that night.
Get out of here.
Karina, for example, she had this large bruise on her left breast. She also felt some discomfort. She would find that there was one on the underside of her foot. Mm-hmm. Both of these little places that she had, the one on the foot and the one on her breast, were both very painful to touch. So while they sat there drinking their coffee, Jane said, "Man, I feel really rough today." And she was, you know, just sitting there talking about it. And as she says this, a couple of drops of blood come from her nose and just drop onto the table.
Whoa.
So obviously, Karina comes over. She puts a towel to her nose, kind of help her out, paper towel. And Jane was talking about how her lower back was really hurting her. Mm-hmm. So Karina said she'd take a look at it, and she discovered a circle burned into her skin.
What?
Almost
in the
like
world?
A brand.
Like a what?
Like a brand, you know, like you would for an animal.
Yeah.
She said it was in the lower middle back area. So after she's telling Jane about her own, you know, bruises and stuff that she's got, she starts checking Jane's body out a little more, and they discover similar bruising to what Karina's was, but she had three strange finger marks on each of her thighs.
Oh, them dang aliens had his way with her.
Incidentally, Jane was visiting Karina from nearby Abbotsford, and in all the light of this recent deals, she decided that I think I'm gonna go ahead and head home instead of wait, because she was gonna stay for, you know, a week or so.
Hell no, I'll be out there too.
She decided to go ahead and cut it short and go on home. So when she gets back home, she goes and sees her doctor and has him examined about her back pain, and then he starts looking at the burn mark on her back, and he said it was similar to a radiation burn.
No way.
So according to Karina, her friend still has problems with this even today. This was 2003.
Like from it hurting and stuff, mm-hmm. You mean?
So then you got the next thing. Here's what we're going to get into. And this thing just keeps getting further and further. We start talking about generational abductions. Now, there's a lot of people that believe that people who get abducted, it's happened for years and years to their family.
Like to the same person?
Well, yeah, like to your grandparents and your parents and kids. And mm-hmm. It's like whatever family you're in, it's like it's went on for maybe even hundreds of years.
Oh, golly.
She thinks she may be one of these that her family's involved. And this is why she came to this conclusion. So her 18-year-old son came home to stay for a couple months. And this was right after she had the sighting. She noticed something on the back, or on his back rather, that would kind of freak her out a little bit. She said that it was a bizarre triangular mark with a strange circle marks within it. Remember, her friend had the burn mm-hmm. that had the circular marks. But here's what sets us apart. She said when she was 12 years old, she noticed just one random morning that she had a similar scoop mark just like that on her leg. She couldn't help but to feel that somehow that mark she got on her leg when she was 12 and the mark on her son's leg now at 18 had some kind of connection to each other.
Well, I don't understand how mom had not noticed that before.
I don't know.
I mean, all those years. Well, and why he never said anything.
Well, it might not have been something that was on his back. Maybe he didn't know it was
he
there.
He didn't even know it was there.
So what made her more concerned, though, was that when her son was 9, so 9 years before that, there was a very, very small hole that was discovered on his spine due to a mystery infection. So one that would actually took months of antibiotics and treatment to cure. So with this in mind, she kind of thought, you know, I'm going to take my son to the doctor. She wanted to kind of find out what that little scoop mark was on his back. But the doctor could not provide any kind of explanation as to what it was.
Not one thing. He just didn't even have a clue.
Nothing. or a reason why they've suddenly just appeared. Now, Karina said that she would notice one morning that when she was leaving the house, that the tops of the trees right there by her home were yellow, like they had been lightly burnt on top.
No kidding.
Now, obviously, if she believes that this could be a generational type abduction, then it would make sense that, you know, maybe even her parents or even grandparents before that probably had some of these situations, you know, that happened with them as well.
I guess they just never talked about it.
I guess not. What's of particular interest here, though, is the fact that the sightings in UFO sightings in British Columbia were at their highest levels in years at that time.
No.
So there actually was some other stuff, you know, going on. In the final days of July and the early days of August of 2003, British Columbia area had a sudden surge of UFO sightings that occurred there. And they said it's not too much of a stretch really to think that Karina and Jane Doe's abduction might have hit during that, you know. So that's the one thing that they got in their favor. There was a lot of other sightings at that time. One particular sighting, though, involved a young lady that lived in Kelowna, which is right where Karina lives. She said that on the evening of the 31st of July, same year, she had gotten out of bed sometime after midnight, after she had, you know, couldn't sleep, so she just gets up and goes out. She said it was really warm, so she went outside in her yard to get some fresh air, and then she said she was looking up at the sky, and she focused on one bright light that she thought was a plane, kind of like they were thinking earlier. She said, however, though, it didn't move like a plane. It was kind of almond-shaped, and she said it glowed a luminous green color, which is exactly what they were saying.
Yeah.
She also noticed that, wow, just a few minutes before that, she could hear all the sounds of nature, you know, the coyotes and mm-hmm. crickets and all that stuff, that now all of a sudden everything was completely silent. She said it was almost like something that just flicked a switch. Now, the details, you start talking about the green light and the locations are right in the same proximity. Even though they're different type stories, there's enough together that kind of makes you think, okay, well, maybe there's some credence.
Yeah, there must be something to it for sure.
Yeah, some credence to what she's saying. As for Karina, since the encounter, she believes that she's unlocked so much of what's happened, looking back to her childhood and all that stuff. She said what's even more is she thinks it's been happening her entire life. She's just really starting to put the pieces together now with this recent one. To see what's going on. But she says that she does think that other members of her family have probably experienced it, even though she doesn't know that. She thinks, for example, that the encounters began for her when she was 4 or 5 years old. She said that being a teenager, the visitations became even more frequent. And she said they would take DNA and other medical samples from her. And perhaps she thinks that the visitations continue today. So several witnesses, including friends and family members, have been present when huge ships have gone over the house, she says. Or she said that they've actually discovered big, considerable amounts of missing time, like when her mm-hmm. and Jane Doe were in the car that day, only to reappear, like in that story, where she's just disappeared and reappeared.
Yeah.
Which is what she was talking about with the story with the guy earlier that we were talking about. She also believes the extraterrestrials involved in these abductions are the grays, which are the ones you commonly see, the big heads, big mm-hmm. rounded heads, the big round eyes, and the little thin bodies. And she says they have basically no emotions. They're like robots. And she thinks that's why they can do all this experimenting on humans and stuff like that and basically not have any emotion. She just, you know, doesn't matter how much pain they go through or any kind of anxiety, they just don't care because they're just here doing a job. That's her approach on it.
So did all the family members get together and talk about this at all?
I haven't seen where all the family members got together. I mean, I'm sure she's written some books and stuff, so I'm sure they probably have for the books.
I was going to say, that's bizarre if they haven't.
But that really goes right back into what we were saying about so many different people within the community feel like that maybe her story was made of something about. There's too many things about her story that people feel like doesn't fit. You know, there's a lot of things in these abduction stories that are very similar, mm-hmm. and hers was completely different than anybody else's, for the most part, with the exception of the green lights and the area.
Well, maybe they just didn't like the other people.
Yeah, it's possible.
And they're like, nah, you're not interesting to me, so they should get over it and not be jealous.
Well, they are. The lights were green with envy. All right, so let's talk about some famous people that have had UFO encounters.
Okay.
And we've talked about some of these before. Dan Aykroyd, obviously.
And Tom Arnold on Roseanne.
Did he have one?
Mm-hmm. On Roseanne.
Oh, well, that doesn't count. I'm talking about real ones.
Oh.
So we talked about John Lennon before. We've talked about, who was that? Just that? Dan Aykroyd.
Uh-huh.
He's a big believer in it. And then we'll talk about some more. Russell Crowe, how about him?
Oh.
So Crowe's one of the most prolific actors, I've been in the world, obviously. And he shared a UFO experience that he said took place right outside of his office in Sydney, Australia. He said he had set up some cameras and he was hoping to kind of capture footage of fruit bats as they explored the botanical gardens.
Mm.
He's a fruit bat.
He is.
He said he was excited enough just to see the videos of the bats doing their thing, but instead he got kind of a big surprise when he reviewed the footage. Instead of fruit bats, the video revealed a strange glowing object in the sky that resembled a glowing yacht.
A glowing yacht?
Yacht.
Oh, damn.
He says he wasn't even thinking about the possibility of capturing UFO footage when he set up this camera, but the bottom line is he thinks that's what he caught.
Why does his have to be a yacht?
He drinks a lot.
I don't know. Gosh.
They weren't going to get too close to him. They were probably afraid he'd come punch him out. This one's pretty cool. Fran Drescher.
I'm sure her voice annoyed them and they just left.
Obviously, everybody knows who Fran is. She's from The Nanny and all that. But Fran says that she thinks that her and her husband were both visited by aliens when they were kids. At the same time, she thinks she was visited while she was riding in a car with her dad, and she thinks he was visited while he was riding in a car with his dad, because they have, and this is what caused their marriage, because they both have similar scars on their hands, and she thinks they were implanted with something.
Holy moly.
How about that? Nick Jonas. Oh, the young girls love that. Obviously, he's from the Jonas Brothers. He said that when he was a teenager, he spotted a UFO. It happened right outside of Los Angeles. He said he saw some objects up in his backyard. He described them as three flying saucers. He had a friend of his out there with him, and the friend confirmed that he wasn't the only one seeing these three different objects up in the sky. This was in 2015. He was really curious, so he went online and confirmed that just 2 weeks prior, there were other people reported seeing the exact same thing in the area.
Well, must be true.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If it's online, it's got to be true.
Yeah.
You'll like this one. Khloe Kardashian and Kendall Jenner.
Oh.
So Khloe and Kendall both said they saw a UFO at the same time in March of 2013. They said, you know, they jumped all over social media and was talking about it. So this is actually pretty popular out there. So they were freaking out over what they saw, but they were intrigued. And Twitter lit up with all kinds of confirmations after they posted it on there. There was more than 1,000 people who joined in to talk about the UFOs, and the sighting happened just before noon during morning hours and created a bit of a sensation.
Huh. They ain't talking about that trip they went on with Bruce, are they?
No. Well, what they were at, they were in Roswell at that time. Kesha, you know who she is?
Who?
Kesha.
No.
She's the pop star. Blonde hair, kind of cute.
No.
Kind of. Anyway, she said she had a UFO experience to talk about. She confirmed that when the incident happened that she was straight-faced sober. So that would have only been like a 5 to 6 minute period during the day. That's pretty impressive. She was in the desert, so she looked up at the sky. And she saw a grouping of spaceships. She wasn't sure exactly how many, and She estimated that there was between 5 or 7 objects up in the sky. She watched the objects trying to figure out what they were. She said they moved out of her line of vision, but she reports that a little bit later they returned and came back in a different formation. She's so convinced that she saw spaceships that she's without a doubt carrying some type of alien life forms. Well, she's not. But she said that she's convinced that there's some kind of alien life forms out there.
What the heck is she doing in the desert?
I don't know. Well, I mean, you could be in Las Vegas and be in the desert.
Well, that's true.
She's incorporated her experience into the music that she writes, and with a song track titled Spaceship, Kesha isn't kidding about her UFO sighting. She's dead serious. The pop star shared this information with the world in an interview with Zach Sang Show in July. It was a life-changing event for the singer, and she said she will never forget.
Could be true.
Well, this one, the next one we're going to talk about is super obvious. Tom DeLonge. He is obviously the former lead singer of Blink-182, mm-hmm. and now he is the premier expert when it comes... but he's the premier guy in force of trying to find all this stuff. He's obviously created his little group, and they're out doing everything they can to try to find evidence now. But he said that... Well, he's the ex-guitarist. I think I said lead singer, but mm-hmm. either way. Anyway... He's got a super strong interest in UFO research, and this goes back to 2015. He said he was camping near Area 51, and he was inside his tent, and it started having these strange sensations. So he said he felt like that his body had just received like a big charge of static electricity, which is similar
to what
she had said earlier in her story. Mm-hmm. He said his eyes had previously been closed, and when he opened them, he could see that the fire that he had built was still going. He heard a group of people talking outside. He said it sounded like a group of about 20 people around the campsite. So he couldn't understand what they were saying, but it was obvious to him that they were working on something. And to think, you know, in case you're not sure how serious Tom is, he left the band to do UFO research, and he actually was awarded UFO Researcher of the Year by Open Minds in 2017. Oh, so this isn't just your run-of-the-mill musician. He started the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he was involved just recently. There was the videos that were released from the Navy mm-hmm. that he got his hands on and released, and everybody was trying to figure out how he got his hands on them. But that was just, a month and a half ago, where it showed 2 or 3 different instances where naval flight pilots were like, oh my God, what is this? What the hell is that right there? That was him who was responsible for putting...
How did he get that?
I don't know. This was supposed to be top secret stuff, and somehow or another, the ex-Blink-182 guitarist ends up with these videos that are supposed to be top secret from the U.S. government.
Well, good for him.
Ryan Adams, you ever heard of him? He's a singer, but it's not Brian Adams. Ryan.
Oh,
Adams.
No. Uh-uh.
He's a pretty well-known singer anyway, and a songwriter. He had a UFO experience. He's a native of Jacksonville, California. I said California, North Carolina. Where that came from. Jacksonville, North Carolina. He said he was driving down a road in Glendale, California, and he spotted this large object in the sky. He was strongly against texting or talking on the phone or anything while driving, so he didn't have a phone camera to try to snap a picture. He says the object kind of flew over his head. He claimed that it was being chased by helicopters. So this proves that somebody else was aware of its presence, and they also wanted to know more about whatever that strange object was. And that's a lie for the government isn't telling us. So it didn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's not
this
surprising.
This happened to him in 2013. What about Lemmy from Motorhead?
Oh, yeah.
He is. He was born in Burslem over in the UK. And at the time he shared this, he was 72 years old. But he said he was at Rock in Rio in 2011, and somehow or another he spied this ship that was cruising over top of a mountain. He said that the craft was moving at an unbelievable speed, which he kind of thought had to be around 1,000 miles per hour based on how fast planes go and what planes look like in the sky and what this looked like. He said that the object came to a complete dead stop. He did confirm that he completely believes that there are aliens, but he didn't seem really excited about retelling this event, almost like he was a little timid. So you watched the CMA Awards last night.
Some of it.
Well, here's one, that a name from last night you may know, Kacey Musgraves.
Oh, yeah.
So Kacey's a country singer, obviously. She was born in Texas, and she lives in Nashville. She had her own experience with extraterrestrial sightings. She said that she was helping a friend prepare for her wedding, and it was being held in Mexico. She wasn't alone there, and there were several other people around her helping her to kind of get ready for this wedding. So the group was on the beach, and after the wedding, they saw an object in the sky that was making these crazy and erratic movements. She confirmed that she hadn't had anything to drink and was totally sober. They watched this object in fascination for about 20 minutes. They claimed that the object even changed its shape and flew across the sky. This was her first UFO experience, but it wasn't her only one. She reported a UFO sighting after the event in Nashville and then again in Los Angeles. This made a believer out of Kacey, who isn't shy about sharing her experiences because there are plenty of people who will back up her claim that were with her. What about Elvis?
Oh, Elvis.
He had his encounters with extraterrestrials. In fact, he claimed to have had many encounters. Probably the drugs. Anyways, according to accounts that Elvis shared, his first was a visit on the day that he was born in 1935. Elvis's hairstylist, Larry Geller, was told the story of how Elvis's father walked outside to have a cigarette during the wee hours of the morning as his wife, Gladys, was giving birth to Elvis. So it's around 2 o'clock in the morning. He said he looks up in the sky and he sees this odd blue light. Now, this was during the time Elvis was born. Now, that wouldn't be Elvis's only encounter with UFOs, because Geller also reported that he and Elvis were driving through the desert one night. Neither had any alcohol or drugs in their systems whatsoever. Liar. Anyways, they were completely sober. The pair said they looked up, saw these strange lights in the sky. Geller reported that they were moving far too fast to be airplanes, so they assumed that they had to be UFOs. Is it possible that Elvis had UFOs following him from the day he was born to the day he died?
Could be, because Elvis is special.
He's special. All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining in on our bonus. We love you and appreciate you.
Love you guys.
Bye. Hey, guys, I am excited to bring this guest on to you guys. You guys are going to absolutely love her. I had a privilege of doing an event with her at the Middle Aged and Creeped Out show this past weekend. And, man, she completely blew me away with not only her credentials, but her ability to just really get the story across. And I'm telling you, there are so much about Betsy Kulikowski to tell you about that I can't even fit it all in the beginning because we'd be here for 20 minutes and I thought I would just gradually bring it on. But I will tell you, Betsy is the author of the best-selling award-winning paranormal thriller, The Veritas Codex, and the series of the same name. She's also a paranormal investigator. She's got some other stuff that is demands as much attention as I can give it in the show, but we'll touch on that a little bit later. Betsy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Jerry. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, I can't wait to get into this. When I heard some of your stories the other night, I was like, man, our listeners are going to absolutely love this. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to get you on so quick. So let's first talk about this, Betsy.
Okay.
You wrote your first book at the age of 6 years old.
Yeah.
Tell me how that happens.
My mom said I've always been a storyteller. My granddad told the most amazing yarns you ever heard. He was an old country guy and he loved to tell stories. So I love stories from the time I was itty bitty. And I learned to read, gosh, I don't even remember learning to read. I learned to read when I was like 3 or 4 years old. My mother was teaching my brother. He was 3 years older than me. So I just learned while he was learning. And so I've always had a book in my hand and I always wanted to tell stories. So she said, I got out the crayons and the cardboard and the construction paper. And I basically wrote all my own books and I gave them away as Christmas presents or something like that. I don't even remember it, but that's the story that's gotten back to me over the years.
So tell me a little bit about the Veritas Codex. You had a fascinating story about how that the series came to be. Sure. And I thought that was fascinating. I thought for people out there that are just really getting started on trying to be an author, that this might be beneficial for them to hear.
All right. Well, I had always been kind of writing in the background and I, you know, most of it was done by hand in a spiral notebook before we had typewriters and computers. I mean, I've always been writing. And in 2009, I thought, you know what? I want to try and write a book just to see, one, if I can, and two, if it's any good. So I was watching one of the travel adventure shows. I don't remember. I think it was Destination Truth at like 4 o'clock in the morning one night because I couldn't sleep. And, you know, we're seven seasons into this, and I'm a big Josh Gates fan, and I love the show. So I'm, you know, watching it, and I'm thinking, you know, 7 years we've been doing this, and they never find anything. Or what if they did, and it's something they couldn't tell us? So it was a truth they couldn't tell. And that kind of became the inspiration for the Veritas Codex series. So it's all about travel adventure show host Dr. Lauren Grayson and her efforts to put on a TV show and go in search of the answers to the world's greatest mysteries from a scientific standpoint. She goes on an investigation in the Pacific Northwest looking for Bigfoot. And in the middle of the investigation, she disappears and she's gone for 10 days. And when she comes back, she's injured. She has no memory of where she's been or what's happened. But all the evidence points to the fact that she was abducted by Bigfoot. But, you know, was it Bigfoot? Was it aliens? It's a pity she can't remember. So that was the first book, and I wrote it, and it probably took me the better part of a year. I had just gotten in with a writing critique group when I started writing it. They kind of helped me get through some of the character development and the plot points, and really helped make it a better book just because of their feedback and input. And I thought that went pretty well, but I really didn't have a path to publication. I could be as outlandish and crazy as I wanted to be, because I didn't think anybody was ever going to read it. So it could be about Bigfoots and aliens and, you know, all kinds of crazy things could happen. So I thought, you know, that was good, but I feel like there's more to the story. So I thought, well, I'll just write a second one just to see if I can maybe write a series. So I wrote a second book, and then I wrote a third book, and then I wrote a fourth book, and I still had no idea what I was ever going to do with it. And I really thought nobody was ever going to read it. I had other books I'd written that I thought would probably have more opportunity to get published in the mainstream market. But I never could let these characters go. They had become a part of me, and I'd gotten to know them really well, and I knew all their flaws and all their quirks and traits. And so I really didn't want to see them just kind of do nothing. So in 2019, I'd started going to writers' conferences, and I'd really kind of found my tribe there. And I found out that there was going to be a writing cruise. So you could go on a cruise, do a workshop, but you had to send in a book and you had to let them read it. And then they'd give you feedback. They'd put you with a coach, and then you'd workshop it and put together a marketing plan and, you know, practice your pitch and all these things that you need to do as an author to try to sell your book. So that's the one I sent in, because it was the one that scared me the most, because I thought, if I'm really serious about this writing, I have to be willing to put myself out there and not be afraid. So we workshopped the book, and they put me with an amazing coach, Laura Bernhardt, who writes the Wantland Files series, which is very much like mine. And I pitched the book, you know, and I'm watching the dolphins out the window as I'm pitching the book. And the only critique I got back from the publisher was, you know, you really need to work on your eye contact. I'm like, yeah, but there were dolphins.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to turn their back on dolphins?
Exactly. I've never really seen them like that. So, you know, lesson learned, don't pitch when there are dolphins outside. And we got back from that cruise on February the 9th of 2020. And we all know what happened in February of 2020, a pandemic hit. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. No books coming out this year. And I was really surprised when I got a call from the publisher who said, you know, I really think this is more interesting than Pixies and Fairies, which is what I thought I wanted. I would love to publish your series if you'd be willing to consider publishing with us. So, you know, we talked about what that would look like and, you know, worked up a contract. I called my attorney and said, hey, can you look at this? And the next thing I know, September of 2020, the Veritas Codex was born.
Awesome. Just to let people know, you know, don't be afraid to take that next step. Don't be afraid of failure, because you taking that next step and taking that cruise has changed your whole writing career from a publicity standpoint, we'll say, you know, because now everybody can read your books where most people probably didn't know about them before.
Right. And one of the things that really kind of came to light that I, you know, was an aha moment for me was the only thing standing in my way was me, because I was afraid to put that book out there. And once I got past myself, everything just fell into place. And, you know, things happen for a reason. And now I have 6 books out. I'm working on edits for the 7th book, and there's already a plan for 12 books. Most of them are mostly written in first draft.
That's phenomenal. So let's talk about some other things. You've got some paranormal stuff we're going to talk about.
Okay.
But before we get into that, because I think it's important because some of the paranormal stuff involves this other stuff. But Betsy, you are a federally trained investigator with 30 plus years experience as an occupational safety specialist, and your degree is in emergency management. Now, some people out there are probably thinking, okay, I'm not really sure what I'm hearing. What all does that, you know, entail? But you have served on disaster response teams at the Mura Federal building bombing, which was the Oklahoma City bombing, is how it's known to most of us, the World Trade Center, Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and a bunch of other disasters in Oklahoma. Tell me how that happens. I know you get, so the getting a degree in emergency management, I get that. How did you end up with so many high profile cases, we'll say?
Well, the funny thing is the degree came afterwards. I had been working for the state since I was 18 years old. I started my first job at the Oklahoma Department of Labor. I was a clerk typist, which, you know, it's helpful that you can type really fast, which, you know, it's a good skill for authors to have. And I used it to type up safety reports and do asbestos licenses. And I had promoted up to an asbestos inspector position. And that's what I was doing when the Murrah bombing happened here in Oklahoma City. I was about 6 blocks away when the explosion happened. It shook the car. It just about blew out windows nearby where I was. I was getting fuel at the motor pool. But I had an inspection to go do, and I had to go away from downtown. But I immediately turned on the radio to try to find out what was happening. And within minutes, they were talking about an explosion downtown, because my first thought was, we have an air park down there. My first thought was an airplane had crashed into downtown. Just an assumption of somebody who didn't know what was going on. And within probably 4 or 5 days, we were down in the disaster zone conducting inspections of the buildings around the Murrah building to see what asbestos was damaged. Most of the buildings north of the bombing had their windows blown out, but most of the windows south of it had their windows sucked out. So there was glass, there were hazards everywhere. We were told not to touch anything because it was an active crime scene, no pictures. You know, do your job, get in there, make sure the buildings are safe, identify what hazards are there if they're not safe. I later went in with helped with a prison crew that they went in to do cleanup in one of the buildings, made sure everybody's belongings and possessions were accounted for. And so that's really kind of where that first experience lie. It was right there in my own front yard. We had a disaster, and it took everybody working together. And we call that the Oklahoma standard. Everybody pitches in to help their neighbors. So when 9/11 happened, I was actually watching it live on television when the second plane hit the towers. And I turned to one of my coworkers and said, we're probably going to get called to that. That's huge. They're going to need help. And within a few weeks, we knew that we were going to go, but we didn't get called to go until March of the following year. They had enough people in their own region to come in and help. And the federal OSHA office was actually destroyed in New York City. It was in Tower 4. And all those other buildings came down on top of it, but they were able to evacuate. But they didn't have offices. They didn't have equipment. So they had to basically set up a whole new field operation to go in and make sure workers were safe during the cleanup. And there were some real challenges with that. I got cussed out by a person of the cloth, a holy man, because he wanted to climb out over the guardrail to take pictures during one of the, when they take a body out that was a firefighter or police officer, they'd have a whole ceremony and we'd all come out of the pit and watch from above. We'd line up and show our respect in that fashion. But he wanted to take pictures. And so my partner grabs him by the belt, pulls him back over, and he just cusses both of us out. And I'm like, look, you can call me whatever you want to, but you'll do it from this side of the barricade. There's nothing underneath there to hold you up. And if that comes down, there'll be another casket they're taking out. And so, you know, I think he probably realized real quickly he was not doing the right thing.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. So after that, when Hurricane Katrina hit, that was our region. That was Region 6, and that was close to home. I'd spent quite a bit of time down in New Orleans prior to that, so I was really willing to go and happy to do what I could do to help down there. We did all kinds of inspections at landfills, buildings. We inspected Charity Hospital to identify what hazards were present so that when they go in to do cleanup, they could do the cleanup on that with all the right equipment going in. 16 days, 12-hour shifts, no days off. Very exhausting, but very, very rewarding. And since then, I actually got my degree in 2018. I'd been doing the work. I just needed the degree to back it up. And FEMA announced that there was a new program that they were supporting, a new college degree program at Rose State College. And they were offering a 50-50 performance grant. And I had almost enough college to graduate. So I was just needing to pick a major, and I had never been able to really find my path. So now that I knew that the emergency management was something that I was willing to do, could do, it was an opportunity to help my neighbors. I was on board. So I went and finished that degree and got a couple certificates to go with it. And I'm one of the few people in the state of Oklahoma that have been through all the same training as a county emergency manager without being a county emergency manager.
Well, I want to take the time on behalf of our audience to thank you for your service and what you do. That's it's absolutely incredible. It's very it's not a self-serving job in any way, shape, or form as far as the hours and stuff put into it. I mean, you obviously though get something out of what you're doing, but it's a thankless job from most standpoints, I would think.
Yeah. Again, my pleasure to serve. It's my honor to be where I am, you know, where I can help anytime. Part of that Oklahoma standard I try to carry with me.
All right. So let's get into the part that my audience is going to love the most. Let's talk about how do you have time to even be a paranormal investigator with everything else you got going on?
I try to be very efficient with the things that I have to do, so I have time to do the things I want to do. So I type super fast. I write really fast. I think the last time I took a typing test, it was 145 words a minute. The typing test nowadays will max out at 150, and I've broken it a few times. So I might have gotten faster than that, but on average, probably closer to 100 words a minute, depending on how the mood strikes me. So, you know, my kids are older now. I finally got them out of the house for the most part. So I have a little bit of extra time here and there. I don't get to do as much as I like, but some of the paranormal investigations I got to do as part of my job, because my job put me in places that were old buildings that were about to be torn down or were under renovation, or at Katrina. Even at Katrina, Charity Hospital was a very interesting location. It's the oldest public hospital in North America. It was built in 1752, and they just rebuilt and added on, and it's huge. It's 27 stories, full city block, and it's right down by the Superdome. So it saw some of the worst of humanity, but it also saw the worst of the disaster, because some people, they couldn't evacuate. As many as they could, they got out, but there were some people that couldn't be moved, and they ended up having to manually ventilate them and keep them alive throughout several days of waiting to be rescued afterwards.
You had made some comments about, not really wanting to go back to the site of the Oklahoma City bombing at the mm-hmm. Bureau Federal Building. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Right. So downtown Oklahoma City, they've gone back in and they built this beautiful memorial. They hold a ceremony every year to remember those that we lost, the 168 that we lost. That include children. It includes husbands and wives, brothers and sisters. These are people who just went to work trying to make a living, and some people that were there as customers. And my own parents were supposed to be down there that morning. My parents had just retired. My dad needed to go to the Social Security office, which was in that building. And they always parked in the area where the survivor tree stands now. And when it happened and I found out where it was, I thought, oh my gosh, I hope my parents aren't down there, because they would have been right in the middle of it. And the telephone systems here shut down. There was no way you could get a cell call out unless you had a special chip in your phone for emergency managers, which I didn't have at the time. And landlines got bogged down really quick. So there was really no way to communicate even with people within the city. So when I tried to call my parents, it just went to their voicemail and you know, there was no answer. And I didn't know where they were for 4 days. And when I found them, my mother is a nurse. She was working at the hospital. My dad was driving people back and forth from the blood bank, trying to make sure they had blood donors taken care of. And they were doing their part. And they were more worried about me because they knew I was supposed to be out doing inspections that morning. So it was really odd how we were able to connect. We actually had to call an aunt in Denver to make contact. So we had to go call somebody out of state before either one of us could make contact. And, you know, it was all well that ends well, but, you know, for 4 days, that was pretty terrifying to not know where your mom and dad were.
What kept them from actually being there? You said they were supposed to go down there that day.
It's the craziest thing. My dad is an avid walker. He decided to take an extra lap that morning at the park. And my mom decided to have an extra cup of coffee and she wasn't in any hurry. And when he finally got home, she still wasn't ready to go. And it was just one of those things. It was kismet that they should have been there and they weren't.
That's awesome though.
Yeah. So, I keep saying I'm going to go down there. And every time I think I can do it, I get to the edge of the property and I've seen from the outside looking in, but I've never actually been able to go through the museum. I know for a fact at one time my hard hat was actually in the museum.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we had donated a bunch of our used our emergency supplies, our safety supplies, hard hats, high-vis vests, things that it was probably close for them to be retired and we had just ordered new ones. So we took all our old ones and donated them. And anything that had a state logo on it, the rescuers from out of state gravitated towards. That was their souvenir. And so one of the rescuers had gotten a hold of my hard hat and his picture was actually in the newspaper. And so somebody had gotten the hard hat and the picture and they were together in the exhibit in the museum. And I was like, that's my hard hat. I knew because there was a little tear on the logo.
No.
I keep saying I'm going to go back there, but I'm not really sure why I can't do it. I don't know if it's, just the memories or the ghosts of those who died. I'm not really sure.
What do you think the paranormal activity is like down there? Have you experienced anything yourself being in the close surroundings, or have you heard much from people that live in the vicinity?
I haven't heard a whole lot about it. I've read some stories online. You know, people have had some kind of account, but I haven't had any personal experiences, and I really haven't seen anything that just made me stop and go, whoa, I need to go check that out. So I'm sure at some point, just with that many people dying, all of a sudden, such a tragic way to go, there's got to be some kind of residual energy left behind, I think.
So Timothy McVeigh, he's actually one of the few people in the country in the past 30 years that actually got the death penalty fairly quick, as he mm-hmm. should have. I don't know much about him, but was he a local mm-hmm. guy? Was he... What do you know about him personally?
I believe he was actually from Kansas. He wasn't from Oklahoma City. He was very upset about the whole Branch Davidian compound being raided. He had been in the military. He was disgruntled against the federal government. And his intention was to do as much damage as he could to the federal government. That was his intended target. Those, again, employees at work. As a safety professional, that hits me right in the heart. So that was his number one target. And the fact that there were children in there did not stop him at all. He knew there were children in there. And today, federal buildings are designed completely different. They're better protected. There was only one security guard in the Murrah building, one, because it was considered such a safe building. But daycare centers aren't allowed to be in federal buildings anymore. And they have more security protocols to keep people from doing something like that.
About some of the other places that you visited from a paranormal mm-hmm. standpoint that kind of stand out to you?
Oh, my favorite place is Fort Reno here in Oklahoma. It's just about 45 minutes outside of Oklahoma City to the west. It was an old Indian fort before statehood. There have been a number of paranormal investigations take place out there because there's so much activity. number of stories that come out of there are just, it's mind-boggling. And I've had my own experiences out there. My mom and I would go out there. My mom's a historian. She loves to do genealogy. And so she had been volunteering out there after she retired. And so she dragged me out there. She said, we need to go do this ghost hunt, because they do it once a month. And then they do tombstone tales at Halloween. And it's really cool. We need to go. So, of course, I'm on board. And we would go out and we would kind of just kind of keep people within the group. We just kind of volunteered to just kind of keep people from wandering off and getting lost or getting hurt. There's a building there called the Old Victorian, which was the officer's home. And we had done some investigations inside the building. At one point, they would let you go in. And I've actually had, there's an area where there were known to be children playing. Several experiences other people had, but I actually had my pant leg tugged on, little hand run up my leg, you know, kind of brushed, you know, how little kids will try to get your attention, touch your leg, you know, pull on your pant leg. You can hear them laughing in the background and turn around and there's nobody there. Little things like that would happen. We take toys up there and like roll the ball and it'd roll back at us. And so we had some very interesting investigations there. And then after they kind of backed off letting people go in because it was under renovation, we would just go around the building and we'd walk outside. And my mother and I were out there one day doing our baseline. We'd always go out before it got dark, just kind of check everything out. One of the windows on the third floor fell out and landed right in front of my mom. And it just seemed kind of coincidental. It was pretty coincidental. It's like somebody didn't want us there. And then I took pictures in all the windows. And after dark, when we came back, there's very clearly a face in the window in one of the pictures. And, you know, you can almost see the handprint and the eye sockets and the outline of his beard. Creeps me out every time I think about it, because he was like, okay, what are y'all doing out there? This is my property. What are you doing? But I've been to the graveyard at midnight out there. They do a lot of fun stuff. Tombstone Tales was one of the coolest things they do. They actually have reenactors come out and tell the story of the people who are buried there, to kind of bring history to life. And one of our legislators was doing a character. He was reading kind of his story and talking about the tragedy of his death and his, you know, fiance and all this kind of stuff. And I'm literally just sitting there just boohooing, because I can see the story playing out. And, you know, being a storyteller myself, if there's no tears in the writer, there's no tears in the reader. And this poor guy's just trying to get through his script and I'm over there bawling and he's barely getting through it. But, you know, it just kind of brought history to life for me. And so there's a lot of interesting things that happen out at Fort Reno. So if anybody's ever in Oklahoma, that's a good place to go check out. And they still do ghost hunts at least once a month. Now that the pandemic is kind of behind us, they're opening up a little bit more. So it's good to see them that they're doing that. I have been to the Strader Hotel. I've been to the Skirvin Hotel here in Oklahoma City. That's an interesting place. Old Art Deco, one of the first big grand hotels in Oklahoma City.
The Skirvin was made famous by all the NBA players that stay there.
Yes, and do you know why they don't like to stay there?
Because of the ghost.
The ghosts scare them out. Well, I've had my own experiences there. I've only stayed the night there once, and I didn't have any experiences then. But back when I was doing asbestos inspections, I was working with some of the construction crews that had been out there. And anytime they had to breach containment, they had to notify their inspector. And we had a high number of breached containments on that. And I, you know, I'm there doing my inspection. I'm like, why are we having these breaches, you know, breach reports coming in? And they're like, well, the water keeps getting turned on in the sink and we have to breach containment because they had it sealed off to go in and turn the water off. And I'm like, what do you mean the water keeps getting turned on? He's like, we can't explain it. We'll turn it off, seal it back up. It's covered in plastic. And then the water just comes back on. I'm like, okay, that's really weird. He goes, well, that's not the only weird thing that's happening. Sometimes the power tools get turned on by themselves when they're not plugged in. And I'm like, that can't happen. They're like, yeah, stick around for a little bit and watch. I never saw it myself, but pretty interesting to hear that kind of thing as a safety inspector.
Now, you had mentioned in the other story where you're talking about the fort, you mentioned reenactors. Mm-hmm. And I can't hear reenactment without thinking of Civil War. And you've had some experiences in Gettysburg, am I correct?
Yeah, I did. My mom and I had gone out there a couple times, and just is one of those places, you know, you feel the heaviness of everything that happened there. And my father-in-law is a huge Civil War buff, loves to do the reenactments, collects cannonballs. I mean, he's into it. He's into it big time. And we had gone out on one day just to kind of hit all the national parks for my national parks passport, make sure I had my stamp on it. And we're walking across one of the battlefields, headed back to the car. And there was a young man sitting by a tree in uniform. He had a Confederate uniform on. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd. I just kind of wanted to walk over and make sure he was okay. And we started over that way and got over there. And I said something about, man, that's a great uniform. That's a great costume. And I turned to look at my father-in-law because he said something of the same effect. And when we turned back, there wasn't anybody there.
Nice.
Very unnerving.
We're talking to Betsy Kulikowski. She is an author of a great book series. Becky, tell Becky, Betsy, I'm sorry. I tried to combine both your names together.
It's not easy to do.
Betsy, tell everybody how they can get to Veritas Codex and any of the other books involved in the series. Anything else that you might have out there, sure. How would they find this?
So I'm really active on Instagram. Author Betsy K is my handle on Instagram. My books are available at Amazon or wherever you buy books. We print on demand. Hey, kitty. We print on demand so that we're not killing trees until somebody wants a book. So I'm a big fan of that. So you can get them at barnesandnoble.com, target.com, walmart.com, Google, Apple, Kobo, Kindle, Audible. The first three books are available in Audible. So anywhere you buy books, you can get a copy of the Veritas Codex. And the second book is The Jaguar Queen. The third book is The Alien Accord. The fourth book is The Monk's Grimoire. The fifth book is The Lost Templar. And the sixth book is The Pirate's Curse. And book seven should be out next year. That's going to be The King's Ransom.
Betsy, it's been absolutely phenomenal having you on. I could listen to you all night long. And like you said, you are a masterful storyteller. And anytime that you want to come on and promote your newest book when it comes out and tell us some more stories, we are here to listen.
Oh, thanks, Jerry. It'd be my pleasure.
All right, Betsy, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.